Welcome to the Lost Debate, a show for political eclectics. I'm Ravi Gupta, and there are a few big updates today. I'm going to start at the top of the show here. One is Biden just signed the so-called TikTok ban, which may or may not be a ban. Essentially, what happens now is ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok, has up to a year to find an approved buyer. They actually have 9 months, and then there's the possibility of a 3-month extension. If they fail to find an American-based buyer or a non-Chinese buyer, they will be banned from the United States app stores. TikTok's CEO has said he will challenge that law on First Amendment grounds. So that's a huge deal. I think this is really the first major so-called internet regulation. I mean, if we want to call it a regulation, it really has less to do with subject matter or general scope, but has more to do specifically with this one company. We've done a few episodes on this, and so we'll put those in the show notes. This kind of came out of nowhere. Harvey Weinstein's conviction was just overturned just a few hours ago. There was a really interesting piece in the New York Times from Jody Cantor, who wrote She Said and broke a lot of the Weinstein stories out there. And she said that the case against Weinstein has been fragile since the day it was filed. Prosecutors moved forward with risky, boundary-pushing bets. And Cantor notes that although there were nearly 100 women who came forward in the press, including with Cantor and others, to share their stories of Weinstein, the case itself only centered on 2 victims who the charges related to. And both of those victims had admitted to having consensual sex with Weinstein at times other than the criminal acts. And what Cantor notes is that that created an issue for this trial, that the prosecutors really tried to introduce more evidence than is typical in a trial. And particularly what they tried to do were they used these what are called Molyneux witnesses, which are people who give their accounts of a crime that the defendant is not charged with. So in this case, they brought forward people who had accounts of sexual assault and other incidences with Weinstein. And it was those charges, Molyneux witnesses, that created the issues that have allowed this appeal to succeed. And this is a 7-panel group of judges that included 3 women. And in the majority opinion, they said, quote, "We conclude that the trial court erroneously admitted testimony of uncharged alleged prior sexual acts against persons other than the complainants of the underlying crimes. No person accused of illegality may be judged on proof of uncharged crimes that serve only to establish the accused propensity for criminal behavior," end quote. So that's the standard. And, you know, I've talked about this in other contexts before, but there's a lot of history of courts excluding testimony like that. If you watch enough TV, you know that this is pretty widespread practice. And at the time, a lot of people were watching that case saying, huh, this is interesting. If this case succeeds now, then these so-called Molyneux witnesses will be pretty widespread, right? But obviously, this is not the kind of thing that is evenly applied across the country. Like a good example is, and it's also not evenly applied in different contexts. A good example is, O.J. Simpson just died. If you remember back during that case, a police officer testified that he had reported to the Simpson household for prior incidents of domestic violence with O.J. Simpson that he wasn't tried for. Now, in that case, it was the same person with the same victim, so it was ruled as relevant. But judges tend to want to keep a pretty narrow definition about relevancy in these types of cases. And in this case, they tend not to want to admit uncharged allegations involving other victims, because the sort of rationale being you deserve a trial for that. And it could be a backdoor way to suggest that somebody is guilty of something. Now, I'm not here to debate whether that's right or wrong, but it is pretty widespread. In the dissent, the dissenters wrote a pretty stinging dissent. They said, quote, "Fundamental misunderstandings of sexual violence perpetrated by men known to and with significant power over the women they victimize are on full display in the majority's opinion." So that was pretty stinging. I think what we're left with, and I think we'll do an episode on this, is what is the legacy of the Me Too movement, right? Like, there are countless powerful people who have been accused of all kinds of behavior, everything from things that are probably not illegal, like Andrew Huberman, where there's a huge debate that I think feels very different around his behavior than would have happened at the sort of height of the Me Too when, you know, Aziz Ansari, who essentially had a bad date, was, you know, subject to, I think, a pretty robust national conversation. The Huberman thing kind of came and went, and there were, it seemed on the internet, just as many people defending him as criticizing him, which I found surprising given where we've been over the past few years. And then there are people accused of illegal behavior and who've settled civil cases who have had no consequences whatsoever in the professional lives. People like Elon Musk, you know, like certain allegations just kind of come and go in ways that certainly wouldn't have been true at the height of the Me Too movement. And so what the legacy is, I think, is complicated here. Now, no matter what happens with Weinstein, his career was crushed by all of this. I think it's hard to imagine him coming back. I imagine they'll recharge him and try to retry him. There's also a separate case going on in LA, from what I understand. But that movement, I think, has a complicated legacy at this point. And we should do an episode on it because this is a shock. This, you know, I used to say, look, like, you know, at least the Weinsteins, meaning like the obvious perpetrators, were brought to justice. And maybe we can't even say that anymore. But the big news this week, at least if you watch the media, is that there are campus protests, we call it unrest, all around the country. The main focus is on Columbia University in my home city of New York. Hundreds of students were arrested or suspended there. An organization called Apartheid Divest, which is a coalition of student groups organizing the protests, has demanded that the school financially divest from companies and institutions that, quote, profit from Israeli apartheid, genocide, and occupation of Palestine. They also demanded an academic boycott of Israeli universities, reparations and low-income housing for Harlem residents, an end to targeted repression of Palestinian students as they see it, the defunding of public safety services on campus, and a call for a ceasefire in Gaza from the university. I'll come back to those demands in a bit. The university, in response to these protests, has kind of been revising its policies to limit protests at certain times in certain areas. That kind of led to last Thursday, when more than 100 students were arrested after the university called in the NYPD to clear out the encampments. The president of the university, President Shafiq, described the demonstrators as unauthorized and said that they were violating campus rules about when and where demonstrations were allowed. Last week, Shafiq testified before a House committee saying the school's policies on student protests were initially not up to the scale of things and that she was going to take a more aggressive stance. The NYPD arrived in riot gear. They cleared out the encampment. They arrested folks, including Isra Hirsi, which is the daughter of Representative Ilhan Omar, Democrat from Minnesota. Shafiq, you know, this was definitely one of those things where the reaction backfired. It kind of gave protesters, in a sense, what they wanted. She wanted to turn down the temperature. It is certainly raised, and there's a new firestorm. Shafiq is catching hell from the left and a lot of her own faculty who are protesting her. But also people like Speaker Mike Johnson showed up and called on the speaker to resign as well and for students to get back to class.
I am here today joining my colleagues and calling on President Shafiq to resign if she cannot immediately bring order to this chaos. As Speaker of the House, I am committing today that the Congress will not be silent as Jewish students are expected to run for their lives and stay home from their classes hiding in fear. In the House of Representatives, we've already acted to address anti-Semitism on campuses. We have passed a number of statutes to address this matter, and we call upon the U.S. Senate to act upon our legislation.
There is all kinds of reactions going on within Columbia. So I talked about the hundreds of faculty members who held a mass walkout. That was Monday in solidarity with the students. There are other professors like Israeli Professor Shai Davidai, who said he was barred from entering campus by officials who told him they couldn't ensure his safety after he tried to lead a pro-Israeli rally. A campus rabbi urged Jewish students to go home early for Passover, saying the campus was no longer safe. And by Tuesday, the school announced it was offering remote classes for the rest of the semester due to campus unrest. It is not specific to Columbia, though. One of the biggest new protests was on yesterday, Wednesday, where dozens of police officers at the University of Texas many of them in riot gear, arrived, some of them on horseback, blocked the path of protesters. This is at the UT Austin campus. At least 34 people were arrested there after refusing to disperse. Governor Greg Abbott said the arrests would continue until the protesters dispersed. He said, quote, these protesters belong in jail. Students joining in hate-filled anti-Semitic protests at any public college or university in Texas should be expelled. This is going on all over the place. Yale, USC. I could go on and on and on and on. Now, what is going on at these protests? I'm going to go through a bunch of different takes here. I'm going to quote a bunch of things, and I don't agree with all these takes, but I want you to get a sense of what different people across the spectrum are saying. Let's start with a clip that's been circulating of some of the protests and what some of their rhetoric looks like. This is protesters, to be clear, outside of Columbia University. Let's go to this clip. All right, just so we're clear, those students were saying burn Tel Aviv to the ground, or whoever those people were. There were a lot of them. And this is right outside of Columbia University. They say burn Tel Aviv to the ground. They were saying all sorts of other things. You know, Tel Aviv, as a reminder, is a city of over 400,000 people. There are other videos and firsthand accounts of Jewish students being assaulted and being told things like go back to Poland or being prohibited from entering their own campus. And that stuff, if corroborated, is appalling. Our friend Isaac Saul over at Tangle, you know, in his piece argued, yes, those things are appalling, but he also had the following to say. He says, there are also some genuinely embarrassing videos of pro-Israel people trying to make innocent things look violent or make themselves into victims. For instance, a pro-Israel account tweeted a video of a bunch of protesters cheerfully dancing in a circle and called it a cult-like tribal dance. Another ex-user posted a video of a woman in a shirt that says Jew with the Star of David painted on it, standing in the middle of protesters while precisely zero people pay her any mind or care that she is there. Then there's the Israeli professor. This is Shai Davidai, the guy I just talked about, who makes me very uncomfortable. Again, this is Isaac talking. He seems to seek out cameras, viral moments, and confrontation as much as he can to get attention, clicks, and social media clout. Victimization porn is becoming more and more common in our country, but I assure you, there are enough bad actors out there that no one needs to manufacture any additional tension. So what Isaac is saying is, like, there's enough bad behavior, we don't need to sensationalize things. There is a really, really good piece in The Atlantic by George Packer, and he traces the history of Columbia University itself as kind of a microcosm of what we're dealing with today. And there was a really heated, violent 1968 takeover of the university that was famous up until now. And Packer quotes in his article a letter from a student at Columbia now that he sent to, this student sent to Packer, and I'll read this for you. The student said, I think the protests do speak to a certain failing on Columbia's part, but it's a failing that's much more widespread and further upstream. That is, I think universities have essentially stopped minding the store, stopped engaging in any kind of debate or even conversation with the ideologies which have slowly crept in to every bit of university life without enough people of good conscience brave enough to question all the orthodoxies. So if you come to Columbia believing in decolonization or what have you, it's genuinely not clear to me that you will ever have to reflect on this belief. And after all this, one day the university wakes up to these protests, panics under scrutiny, and calls the cops on students who are practicing exactly what they've been taught to do the second they walk through those gates as freshmen. So that was the student's take. And then Packer goes on to say the following. The muscle of independent thinking and open debate, the ability to earn authority that Daniel Bell describes as essential to a university's survival, has long since atrophied. So when, after October 7th, Hamas attacked Israel, Jewish students found themselves subjected to the kind of hostile atmosphere that, if directed to any other minority group, would have brought down high-level rebukes, online cancellations, and maybe administrative punishments. They fell back on the obvious defense available under the new orthodoxy. They said that they felt unsafe. They accused pro-Palestinian students of anti-Semitism, sometimes fairly, sometimes not. They asked for protections that other groups already enjoyed. Who could blame them? They were doing what their leaders and teachers had instructed them was right, the only way to respond to a hurt. So that's Packer. Essentially, he's saying, like, and we talked about this a bit at the university president hearings that were going on, is that the universities have kind of, they're reaping what they sowed. In the New York Times, John McWhorter, who's a professor at Columbia, he had a piece called "I'm a Columbia Professor, the Protests on My Campus Are Not Justice." He said, quote, "I thought about what would have happened if protesters were instead chanting anti-Black slogans or even something like DEI has got to die, to the same sound-off tune that From the River to the Sea has been adopted to. They would have lasted roughly 5 minutes before masses of students shouted them down and drove them off campus," McWhorter said. "Why do so many people think that weeks-long campus protests against not just the war in Gaza, but Israel's very existence are nevertheless permissible?" He went on to say, "Calling all this peaceful stretches the use of the word rather implausibly. It's kind of odd. It's kind of an odd kind of peace when a local rabbi urges Jewish students to go home as soon as possible, when an Arab Israeli activist is roughed up on Broadway, when the angry chanting becomes so constant that you almost start to not hear it and start to feel normal to see posters and clothing portraying Hamas as heroes. I maybe think the war on Gaza is no longer constructive or even coherent. However, the issues are complex in ways that this uncompromising brand of power battling is ill-suited to address." That's John McWhorter. On the opposite side of this debate is Robert Reich, who is the former labor secretary for President Clinton and a professor. He said, quote, "Protesting against this slaughter is not expressing anti-Semitism. It is not engaging in hate speech. It is not endangering Jewish students. It is doing what should be done on a college campus, taking a stand against a perceived wrong, thereby provoking discussion and debate. The Israel-Hamas war is horrifying. The atrocities committed by both sides illustrate the capacities of human beings for inhumanity and show the vile consequences of hate. For these reasons, it presents an opportunity for students to re-examine their preconceptions and learn from one another. The mission of a university is to coach students in how to learn, not tell them what to think. It is to invite debate, not suppress it. Truth is a process and method, more verb than noun, which is why universities should encourage and protect unpopular views. It's why unpopular speakers should be invited and welcomed on campus, and why peaceful demonstrations should be encouraged, not shut down. It is never appropriate to call in armed police to arrest peaceful student demonstrators." So that's Robert Reich, the Wall Street Journal editorial board. So those are two liberals I just mentioned, McWhorter and Reich-ish, liberal-ish people. Here's a conservative take. The Wall Street Journal editorial board said the following: "Universities are supposed to be places where students and faculty can debate politics and other subjects without fear or censure. As the anti-Israel protests spread at Columbia, Yale, Harvard, NYU, and elsewhere, however, progressives are claiming that any restriction on the protesters is a violation of free speech. That isn't true, and it's important to understand why. The First Amendment doesn't apply to private citizens or institutions except in rare instances when they are acting as government agents. Columbia's code of conduct says that a person violates the rules who engages in conduct that places another in bodily danger or harm, or uses words that threaten bodily harm in a situation where there is clear and present danger of such bodily harm. The protesters also don't have a right to assemble on school property to disrupt the functioning of the university or intimidate students on the way to class. Even at a public university, all these rules will constitute reasonable restrictions on the time, place, and manner of speech." Okay, those are a bunch of different perspectives, right? What is my perspective here? Well, I have a couple of different takes here, and some of these are just in the form of questions I have. Question number one is, how much does this all matter, right? Like, what does it matter that we're a bunch of students are camping out at Columbia University? Well, in isolation, it might not matter, but it matters when the Speaker of the House goes there, members of Congress go there, Biden commented on it at least twice, Congress is holding hearings, right? That matters. I think it also matters because, although like the ultimate, you know, Isaac Saul said this in his newsletter, what really matters is what's happening in the war, of course, right? But I do think these moments are a reflection of where we are as a society, right? Like, we are a vain society, America. Everything's about us, right? In this case, what does this say about where we are right now? And I think in that sense, it's worth commenting on. It also obviously has to do with young people and what they believe. And I get this because I do think that these types of protests shape a generation. I'll give you my example. The first protests I ever attended were roughly right in parallel with each other. I attended the Iraq War protests in 2003. And I also, back then, I was very squarely pro-Palestinian, and I attended pro-Palestinian protests on campus as well. And I would say the Iraq War protests, for example, shaped a generation. It was that sort of student activism, that you could draw a straight line from that to me joining Obama's campaign, which changed my life. It changed the life of a lot of people in my generation. It really shaped how we saw Obama. It also separated us from the generation that was more likely to support Hillary Clinton, right? I mean, and it isn't that simple, obviously. There were people in that generation who supported Obama too, but our generation was defined by that. So I think these moments are important. The other part here is I want to spend more time on what these students are asking for and what their arguments are than whether they have a right to protest or not. Because I think all reasonable people, you're listening to the Lost Debate podcast, you believe that whether it's in the lawn or on a message forum or in a barricade outside, that no matter how offensive, even the stuff that we just saw, people have a right to say those things. When it turns into violence, it's different. And now where you're allowed to be is a whole different story. We'll get to that. But what are they asking for? I mentioned their demands earlier. One of those demands is that Columbia calls for a ceasefire. What are we talking about? Columbia University calling for it? What does that matter at all? Like, it won't have any impact on anything. It seems like a waste of everybody's time to focus on Columbia University's policy when it comes to this war. Douglas Harris, the writer, had a funny comment when he was on the Sam Harris podcast. And he was talking about the Chicago City Council, which had voted for a ceasefire. He said, maybe the Chicago City Council should be focused on a ceasefire in Chicago. And I think it was a funny moment, but it's a bit true. It says, like, focus on what you focus on. You're an institution of higher learning. You're students at a university who are about to take final exams. If you're going to protest somewhere and you're going to ask for a ceasefire, protest where it matters, right? I'll tell you my example of the Iraq War. I didn't ever protest on campus for the Iraq War because it's a waste of time, like in front of the university administration. Who gives a shit, right? I went down to the UN. We took buses down to the UN and we protested outside the UN when Colin Powell was giving his famous speech advocating for our allies to join that effort. Now, that's a protest that matters because the people inside that building are actually the most important decision makers on this issue. So I think it's a bit silly to call on your university to have a ceasefire. I think the other part of this is like this divestiture and all that, I think is interesting. And there's a long history of divestiture, including with the apartheid stuff going back to the 80s and early 90s. But one thing I'm a little bit concerned about is the lack of consistency, right? It's one thing to say, all right, I am such a humanitarian that I am holding Israel to the highest of possible standards in how they conduct this war, which I do think they deserve to be held to the highest possible standards. And I have been critical of a lot of what they're doing here. And to say, I am holding them to the same standards I'm holding everybody else to. That is often not what's going on. It's not happening with these protests. It's not what's happening at the UN, where they've passed more resolutions against Israel than all these other major human rights abusers combined, right? You rank North Korea and Iran and yada, yada, yada. You put them all together and there are more General Assembly resolutions condemning Israel than all those folks combined, which seems like a problem. But I think particularly in the university context, I'm confused because yes, let's have the debate. Like, what are the issues you have with Israel? I imagine we'd agree on a lot of those things. What's confusing to me though is why we think certain countries should be called out and we should be calling on our university to end partnerships with certain countries and not others. One big example is Saudi Arabia. The U.S. gives more arms to Saudi Arabia than every other country, including Israel. Now, Saudi Arabia has been waging a war in Yemen since 2014 that has claimed at least 150,000 lives just from the killing in the war and another 277,000 at least, and this is from a few months ago, this data, from the famine that resulted in that war. I don't see any protests about that, right? And I actually think it's a complicated war. But I also think that the Gaza campaign is a complicated war. And I'm confused as to why we choose some wars and not others. Because the argument would be, well, the U.S. gives so much aid to Israel, but we give more aid to Saudi Arabia than anybody else. And obviously, there's a huge relationship there. So why aren't we spending a lot of time on that? I think we should. A bigger, more like glaring example to me as an alumni of Yale University is China, right? Yale has a long history with China. They have Yale and Peking campus. They have the biotech program in Peking. They have a genetic center in Fudan. They have the Light Fellowship, which sends people to China. They have the Yale Law School China Center, which was funded in part from an Alibaba billionaire who donated to create this China Center. I can go on. There are tons of students from China at Yale, and nothing wrong with that, having students from other countries. But what's confusing to me is that this has prompted so little attention from the activists. And I'm wondering why. Because China not only has one of the most egregious human rights records, period, but has an egregious human rights record against Muslims. They have been detaining over a million Uyghurs in Western China. They prohibit those Uyghurs from practicing their religion. They have killed so many of them. They've been incredibly accused of genocide. A lot of them are forced to pick cotton. Like, these are essentially modern day slaves. I have yet to see anything approaching the kind of activism we see on the Israeli-Palestinian issues for the Uyghurs. And again, what I'm saying is, let's allow people to debate, let them protest, but let's actually engage in this debate. And part of engaging in those debates is, well, why is there a selective emphasis? A lot of the Jewish student groups would say is the selective emphasis is born of anti-Semitism. What others would say is, well, maybe it's not anti-Semitism, but it's this decolonial narrative where we say, well, what's the difference between all these situations? Well, Saudi Arabia is brown people violence. China are Asian people on Asian people violence, right? It's not a white oppressor. So some people are saying that's doing a lot of the work here. That could help explain why, for example, we're in the middle of an election in India where Modi is, in all likelihood, about to get a third term. Almost all these universities we talk about have very strong relationships with India. Some of them have campuses in Mumbai, like I believe Columbia and NYU do, or at least one of them does. And Modi has, I've spent a lot of time on this issue, and I'm about to do a whole podcast on this. Modi has an egregious record on cracking down on Muslims within that country. You don't hear a effing thing about this on campuses right now. And so what I'm wondering is why the selective emphasis, and let's have that debate. Let's have it. I would love to spend less time on whether the students should be here or whether they should be there, and more on, well, what do they want? Because I think Packer is right. We have not done these students a service to say, hey, you're coming in with these ideas of anti-colonialism. Maybe our professors are teaching you those things too. Let's actually go at it and talk about what these ideas mean in practice, and whether whiteness is the defining characteristic, or whether power is the defining characteristic, whether authoritarianism is the defining characteristic, whether the antipathy towards democracy is a defining characteristic, like, say, for instance, in Russia, which is a white country that has incredible hostility towards democracy, such hostility that they're literally trying to decimate a democracy on their borders and trying to destabilize our democracy, which is something that we've covered quite consistently. Now, as it relates to the question of whether the students have a right to protest or not, again, I think they do. I do think, though, that there are certain spaces that should be allowed for protesting and not when it comes to a private campus, especially when students are paying $66,000+ a year to attend that institution, and not including other things like board, I imagine. So like the average student who goes to Columbia University is spending about $350,000 over 4 years to attend that institution. A lot of families are struggling and working really hard to get their kids into that institution. And having classes that have to be online or canceled when you're paying that kind of money, those parents and those kids deserve their education. They also deserve to sit there on the lawn after paying $350,000 in a couple of weeks and see their kids receive their diploma, right? They deserve that. And the university is totally within their rights to say the particular space that the students are on right now needs to be cleared for graduation, right? They need to make sure that there's space, time, and energy for debates wherever that will be, but it doesn't have to be that long. And I think this is an impossible situation for the current president of Colombia. Who knows whether she survives? There really isn't a constituency for common sense anymore, and I'm not sure she's done everything right here either. But it's depressing. And I think so many of you come to this podcast with different views on this issue, and I can only imagine you don't agree with everything I just said. But it really pains me to see people who are claiming the mantle of free speech, but are unwilling to use that to engage in an actual debate with people who think differently than them. Because then what is the point of having the free speech in the first place? So my hope is people start engaging. We actually have a real debate about this issue because it's a long time coming. It's why I love doing this podcast. All right. Well, I am excited to welcome one of the newest members of the Branch team, Kerry Rodriguez, who is the co-founder and founding president of National Parents Union. She has been an advocate building parent power all across the country, helping parents fight for better schools. And she is also the co-host of the National Parents Union podcast that is here on the Branch. You could subscribe. It is in the show notes. You can get it wherever you get your podcast. Their first episode just came out this week. Kerry, congratulations and welcome to the team.
Thank you so much. We're so excited. But you did forget my most important title. You got to lead with it. I'm Matthew, Miles, and David's mom. And a big Woburn basketball fan, too.
Where's Woburn, by the way? I'm embarrassed to ask.
It's like 5 minutes outside of Boston. And I spend my time either working with parents around politics, or I'm at fifth and sixth grade basketball games. Literally, that's my whole life. So wow. Lots of little boys in this house.
Staying busy. And you just released this podcast. And I wanted to start because we have spent a lot of time in this podcast talking about another parent group, which is Moms for Liberty. And so I think it would be helpful to just start and say, you know, who are you? What makes you different than an organization like Moms for Liberty? You know, what are sort of their defining characteristics from what you could tell? And what are you advocating for? And how are you organized?
What's very different from us from the jump is that I would never have the audacity to say that I speak on behalf of American families unless I had some data to back it up. We have the longest running poll of parents in America. We're out there, we're asking the questions, we're finding out, hey, actually, why don't we ask parents what they're concerned about? Do they actually care about books in libraries and potentially their kids being exposed to pornography and, oh my God, race issues? We went out and asked the question several times in polls to say, like, well, according to Moms for Liberty and half these folks, if you listen to them, like, this is what's keeping us up at night. And we said, well, it's not keeping us up at night. Economic issues are keeping us up at night. Like, we're trying to get the child tax credit passed. We're concerned about our kids' mental health, the fact that they can't read. And so we've been running these polls, 38 national polls, over and over and over again, so that we can show up and not guess what American families are concerned about. We know because we're in community with them, because we are them. We're not a manufactured campaign. The women who are the organizers of the National Parents Union, the women that joined me on our beautiful new podcast, Tafshir Cosby, Bernita Bradley, Ariel Taylor Smith, myself, I'm an old lady. I've been a community organizer for 25 or 30 years now. I've been organizing girls to fight for a long time. You know, this is not something that I came up with when, you know, a think tank came to me 3 years ago and decided, oh, you know what would be interesting? Parents seem to be angry. Let's monopolize or capitalize on that moment. So again, coming with data and not just showing up mad and whining, we're very solutions oriented. We also have the only parent-led policy center in America. We write our own policy papers. We write legislation. We write policy. We get parents elected. We get things done. We don't talk about it. Like, these guys are real good at getting folks to show up at a microphone, half of whom aren't actual parents or haven't had a child in K through 12 education in 30 years. You know, we actually have skin in the game. We're showing up with solutions. And that's something that's very different about us, too.
With that said, I wanted to talk to you about just some of the, you know, major issues that we have going on right now. As a starting point, you know, you have so many chapters around the country. So you have like probably a strong sense, and you talked about this poll that you've been conducting. What have you learned in this sort of coming out of the pandemic with all of these issues of student absences and inflation and educational choice issues and all the different fights that are happening around the country and the polarization? Like, what is rising to the top right now? What are you hearing from parents about what they're most concerned about?
Well, it's interesting that you bring up all of those topics, because it's like the laundry list of what people blame us for. If there's a problem going on with kids or there's a problem going on with community or American society, it's on the backs of parents. Chronic absenteeism. Oh my gosh. Why don't you lazy people just send your kids to school? Don't you know it's important? We just did a poll of parents to say like, hey, are you sending your kid to school? Do you think this is a problem? And if you're not sending your kid to school, why not? Because we're actually taking the time to ask them questions like that. And they say, you know what? School is boring. The value proposition that we see in classrooms is just not there anymore. We've seen too much during the pandemic, and we realize that there's not a lot to love going on in classrooms. There's no innovation. We're not preparing kids for economic mobility. Our kids can't read, you know? And so we're taking the time to actually ask them those questions. Now, broadly, we're a very intersectional group as well. I mean, we're very concerned about education because that is our hope for the future. But the number one issue for parents is economics right now. We are struggling. And it's for a number of different reasons, from economic conditions to the fact that the parents of today were the chronically underserved kids of the previous generation. There's not been any restorative justice with us, yet we get blamed for the fact that we're living in poverty because we didn't work hard enough. We got a system that's set up to not even teach us how to read. And then at the same time, we'll get blamed for that too, because if you're not reading to your kid for 20 minutes a night, they'll tell you it's your fault that your kid doesn't know how to read. I'm not a literacy expert. And me reading to a kid 20 minutes a night, that's going to overcome 6.5 hours of absolutely failed literacy curriculum that we know doesn't work, that we don't feel like updating because it actually takes effort to teach the science of reading. Come on now. But this is why we have to be a part of the conversation, because without us and without people like us and our voices, those things are left unchecked. Chronic absenteeism would just be lazy parents. We should throw them in jail because they're not sending their kids to school. No curiosity around, well, why aren't kids wanting to be in school? Because it's not engaging. It's not valuable anymore because of what we've done.
Are we setting up a standard that's unachievable? Like, I was bored in school, you know, and I went to school many, many years ago, you know, and I don't know a single person who wasn't bored at various points. Like, is there anything new about, you know, how people feel about school now?
Yeah, because we have a chronic absenteeism problem that doesn't just impact kids. We don't have enough teachers that are actually showing up in school. Are we going to talk about that? Because when we talk about being bored in school, half the time it's because if you're lucky enough to be in a classroom that gets to have a substitute, you're sitting there watching a movie or you're playing a game. You're not actually learning anything. So I hear you on that. But I think that there is a real difference because, you know, at least we could get grownups in the building. At least we could get them, like, we could get something happening. Now we have a chronic absenteeism issue with teachers, with support staff, with specialists, like all of these things. And that's a piece of the pie that we're not talking about at all.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the youngins, The Economist had a really interesting article that I wanted to talk about, because so much of what we hear about with Gen Z is negative. And people rightfully point out the sort of tremendous negative toll that cell phones have had on this generation, which I certainly buy into a big chunk of that. But The Economist has a sort of different thrust to their argument. And just to establish this, when we talk about Gen Z, we're talking about the roughly 2 billion people who were born between 1997 and 2012. And this group in America and the UK make up 1/5 of the population. It's about the same size as baby boomers. In other countries like India and Nigeria, they're by far the most numerous. And the sort of narrative around this generation is that they are a devastated generation, both because of the cell phones and how that's impacted teen mental health and just attention span, and also the pandemic, which was a defining characteristic for them. What The Economist says is these folks are actually better off than we think. And yes, a lot of that stuff that we talked about is, of course, negative. But in many places, they're better off than their parents. And this is especially true in developing countries or emerging countries, however we want to talk about them. And roughly 4/5 of the world's 12 to 27-year-olds live in those emerging economies. And so they talk about how, like, actually, in The Economist article goes through this, a lot of these economic markers actually show that Gen Z folks are more employed, making higher wages, and taking on more practical jobs than their parents were. Do you find this convincing?
I do. And I am a little biased, though, because I did make a couple of Gen Z folks with my own body. So I got a soft spot. I like them a lot, especially the ones that I made. What I think is kind of funny is that, you know, this is what we want for our kids. I tell my kids all the time, listen, you guys are growing up soft on purpose. You know, I don't want you to have the life that I had. I grew up in trauma. I grew up, you know, I was impacted by, you know, social services. I had a mom who was an alcoholic. I like just, you name it. It was trauma, food insecurity. I was homeless, like when I was 15 years old. Like all of the dreams that I have for my children are around wanting these things. And then we complain that, you know, they are growing up soft on purpose. And oh my gosh, because they're not in a constant state of fight or flight. Yeah, they do have time to, I don't know, explore themselves, their feelings, have boundaries, you know, all the things that we say we want them to do around like, tell me how you feel, tell me what you think. They're telling us, and now we're complaining about it. Like, come on. I know it's uncomfortable. Change is uncomfortable for us, but you know what? There's a lot of good that comes with it. And I am actually fascinated every single day by what, you know, I learned from them. One of the beautiful things that I think has come around this generation is understanding and appreciating things like neurodivergency. And that's no longer a deficit, it's a difference. And I have a child, my oldest son has autism and obviously has a different perspective, but he's not growing up in a world anymore where he has to be treated as if like, you know, he should be locked away someplace because he's not a people guy. And, you know, he's a brilliant artist and probably could be, you know, brilliant in cybersecurity because has intense focus. I mean, he has assets that come with that diagnosis that I wish I had. And more generally speaking, all of these kids have assets and qualities now that I wish I had when I was a kid. I think it's just going to take some adaptation for us as adults to realize it's a different world. And when you get into the thing around cell phones and you get into the thing around social media, again, we are trying to put a really antiquated lens on what their experience should be. And life is different and society is different. You're trying to tell me that kids shouldn't have cell phones. I don't know about you, Ravi. I got my cell phone right here. My cell phone is always with me all the time. And then I'm going to turn around and tell my kid, well, no, it's okay if mommy does it, but like not for you. Think about like our society has evolved and changed. And the other thing I would point out again, because I'm not going to say that like what I think represents all American families. We actually did a poll. We asked parents. Parents actually like kids having cell phones. Like they think it's great. For the aspect of it being a communications tool. I love it because even my fifth grader, sometimes when he gets anxious, he has an anxiety diagnosis, he'll go to the bathroom because he thinks he made a mistake and made a teacher mad. And he's so upset. And oh my God, I love the fact that he calls mommy from the bathroom, like, and we can take a deep breath.
This is great. Okay, so hold on. This show is called The Lost Debate. So I actually think we're going to have to lean into the debate here because as a former school principal, I'm going to have to take the other side of this debate.
Okay.
So, okay. We recently had Pamela Paul from the New York Times on who wrote this piece called The Parents Are the Problem. Now, my thesis is going to be a little bit in that. And I want to say at the outset, I love parents. Obviously, that's why we're doing this podcast with you guys. Parents are my main constituency, but I think parents make it really hard to run schools because having cell phones in the building, especially when the parents are insistent on it, makes it hard to ensure that the kids are focused. It makes it hard to ensure that the kids aren't like engaging in certain toxic behaviors within the building that could cause all kinds of bullying and other things. And you know, generally speaking, I view the school as like a counterweight to whatever's happening outside of society. And I think you're right to point out that the issues with cell phones are not unique to the kids, but I think the impact is felt disparately because you and I had the benefit of growing up without the cell phones and now we have them. So our development wasn't affected in the same way that it may be with kids. And if I'm running a school, I'm like, hey, I want the kids reading. I want them performing difficult math. I want them engaging in conversations with the people around them and looking each other in the eyes. And I don't want like communication to be happening amongst kids in a building that we can't, you know, can't get to the bottom of, right? Like if there's like, you know, I can't tell you how many investigations I had to conduct of really horrible bullying where we just weren't able to find the information because of digital privacy and all that kind of stuff. So I'll pause there and just say, this is the last debate.
I think this is a fundamental
tension between school leaders and parents, I think.
Okay, so here's what I'm going to throw at you. Number one, okay, I hear from a lot of educators, whether it's teachers, whether it's principals, you know, policymakers, parents, we really want you to engage. You're part of the team. You're your kid's best advocate, first teacher, all of this stuff. We need your support. We need you on board. I'm on board. You know, when my kid's calling me from the bathroom because he's freaked out that he's made a mistake and stepped in it with his teacher and he doesn't know how to de-escalate, he's panicked. I'm on board. I'm on the team. I'm saying, okay, let's take a deep breath. We're catastrophizing here. Okay. It's not that bad. Mrs. Green loves you. She knows how you are. Okay. Wait, let's take a breath. Let's get it together and let's go in. Let's take responsibility for our behavior and go apologize. Okay. And let's restart our day. That's me being on board and being on the team as a parent. And I know that when I take a look at our polling, where upwards of 78% of American families actually feel really strongly that during appropriate times in school, they should have access to that. Like, I don't know, you're going to have to present a pretty compelling argument there.
What do we think about having the kids, you know, obviously, like, they're going to need it in some way to walk home or whatever, that they bring it to school, they put it in some kind of pouch in the back of the classroom. And like, of course, like if the student is like, and it's an appropriate time for it, the student's like, hey, I'm having a tough day. Can I excuse myself and go to the cell phone room or whatever, or take my phone and whatever, you know, go to wherever one goes with the cell phone. And you say, of course, yeah, it's like a break or whatever. But there's a difference between that and a kid. You know, I've done a lot of school visits recently where I'm just like in a math class and kids are texting each other. The teacher can't in any way control the room, and there's no like attention paid to the academics. And I'm like, there needs to be some kind of balance here, you know?
Well, and here's where I would push in on educators at this point, because again, this technology is not going away. You and I have just had a 20 minute long conversation, and I've been engaged with you and looking you in the eye. I haven't been texting or looking at my cell phone or anything else because I understand how to self-regulate, how to be appropriate with technology. These are skills we need to teach kids. Like, and we need to have educators updating their practice, having better classroom management, better relationships with kids so that we have the space to be able to actually teach those skills, because this technology is not going away. And the idea that you are just going to lock these devices up, devices again, like when you're at work, when you're anywhere, you have all this technology in your hand 24/7. Like, that's where we are right now. What we need to be doing is having educators engaged in professional development so they can teach kids those self-regulation appropriateness skills. And I, as a mom, do the same thing at the dinner table, because I don't want to hear YouTube and YouTube shorts and TikTok and all the loud blare. I have 5 boys. Do you know how loud it is in my house if you have all those devices going? It's loud. So I lay down the law. Like, this is dinner time. Let's look each other in the eye. Let's be polite. Let's talk. Let's interact. It's our job as grownups to teach them how to responsibly use technology. And if we don't, then yes, we're going to end up with a generation of zombies. But that's the hard work of being the grownups here, being a parent, being a teacher, all of that.
Yeah. And I think the interesting place for sort of negotiation / diversity here is because I think you like me are a proponent of school choice, is that I think like one of the reasons why I like school choice is like my school, the dinner table is the entire school day, essentially. So I'm saying, all right, the whole day, we're not on the phone. Now, I understand that that's not the only way to do it. And one of the reasons why I like school choice is, I don't know if that should be the entire school district or not, right? But parents who really want that for their kids can go to that school. The parents who are like, you know what? Like, I actually want my kids, you know, Kim Kardashian's kids. She wants her kids on the phone all day, because that's like how they view success in this world, is the ability to market yourself and navigate this incredible device. And they view that as like an important skill that they want their kids to master within the school day. Great. There should be schools for that, right? That actually have a more permissive policy for that. And I think that's one of the many areas where you and I have common ground on this, is like, that's why we like school, because like, it's like having a school for the arts, or having a school that does classical education, or a school that is more heavily into some sports or others, you know?
There are some people that like the schools that Ian Rowe runs in New York City. I would never send my kid there because I don't believe in a lot of the cultural philosophy around how your family structure is going to determine your destiny. He's got a whole class for that. Maybe some parents like that and want that drilled into their kid's head. If that's what floats your boat, man, like, that's your choice and your option. Maybe your kid needs that level of structure. I would prefer to have the option to send my sons to Sharif El-Mekki. They did that during the pandemic. We went to Freedom School and, you know, we saw their literacy rates jump 5 levels because they were in front of Black and brown teachers for the very first time in their lives, right? And they lit up. They're like, oh my gosh, there's teachers like me. I never had teachers like this. I want to be able to choose that option. So, you know, different strokes for different folks for sure. But I would also say, and I'll give you a little sneak preview, that this week we are putting out a brand new survey. Because again, always in the field, always asking questions because we're curious about how parents feel. And 91% of American families told us that they actually believe that parents should have public school options and the ability to self-determine like what public school their child should go to and have that variety available to them.
Well, I hope, you know, your home state senator, Elizabeth Warren, who's flip-flopped on this issue, hopefully she flips back and you can help her see the light on this issue.
That girl needs a lot of help. A lot of help. She doesn't live too far from me either. I'm going to go over to Cambridge
soon. She used to
be
pro-voucher, not even just pro-charter. And then the teachers union came calling. But okay, there's so much for you and I need to talk about. We'll have to do this more often now that you're a member of the team. Huge fan of your podcast. There are a lot of people in our audience who are going to love what you had to say because I get so much pushback on my cell phone opinions. So I think you will have earned some fans just for that strident defense. And thank you for all you're doing there, not just as a parent, but as an advocate for other parents and everybody out there. Check out the National Parents Union podcast. We'll have a link in the show notes. And if you like the podcast, give a review like everything else. It's especially important in the early days of a podcast to rack up those reviews because it shows other people that this is the real deal. Carrie, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. And we will be back next week. There's so much happening here in the great city of New York and in this country and world. It's possible I might even be on before then. You never know. Every time I refresh the Wall Street Journal page, there's another crazy story. So have a great weekend, everybody. Enjoy the beautiful weather. If you're in most swaths of the country, it's going to be gorgeous. Talk to you Tuesday.